listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And for those of us watching TV, presumably you can still hear my voice, but our video system just crashed. It's rebooting. But we are here, and we are on the air. And Senator Sanders, I mentioned earlier, Bernie's not going to be with us today. He's got a he's traveling. He's got a gig going on. And so for our first hour, I wanted to – it's been a while since we had our old friend Ravi Batra on, and professor of economics at Southern Methodist University, internationally best-selling author of The New Golden Age, The Coming Revolution Against Political Corruption and Economic Chaos, and Greenspan's Fraud, How Two Decades of His Policies Have Undermined the Global Economy. His website is Ravi Batra, RaviBatra.com. And so I wanted to get him on for the first hour, and then we'll do Anything Goes Friday for the second and third hour. You can take questions from you if you have any specific ones, although Dr. Batra does not offer investment advice. He's a professor of economics. But let's talk about the economy. Dr. Batra, welcome back.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks for joining us. So, it's been a while since we've talked. I'm curious your thoughts on the current state of the economy. I'm hearing stuff that's all over the map.
Well, I have been saying for a while that if we keep doing what we have been doing for the past 4 or 5 years, a lot of government spending and the Federal Reserve bailing out so many businesses, then we'll be stable at the bottom. Stabilizing at the bottom means very low growth rate, still high level of unemployment. The interesting part is that the Great Recession started in 2007, and now it is 2014. 7 years later, the total employment level is still below what it was in 2006 or 7.
Right.
So, and we have added about $8 or $9 trillion to the national debt in the process. So, it's a very wasteful use of resources. And we are just going to be muddling around at the bottom if we don't do anything else, something else.
What? So this is, kind of a stagnant economy that's just going to stay stagnant? Is that what you're saying?
That's right. It's a stagnant economy. It's going to stay stagnant if we keep doing what we are doing. And if something goes wrong, it could go back into recession. As far as employment is concerned, we are still in recession.
Uh-huh.
Production is very low. Growth is very low. So I don't know what to call it. It's a stagnant economy with employment still in recession.
Right. And what would be your policy prescription for this? If you were, advising the president or leading the Fed, what would you do?
Well, by the way, I'm writing a new book on the same subject that you just mentioned. And the title of my new book is going to be Ending Unemployment in 2 Years.
Whoa.
Right. So it's very easy to unemployment in the U.S. economy. It's going to be tough in Europe and elsewhere. But in the United States, it's very easy because the country has such a huge trade deficit. And the trade deficit is total wastage of consumer demand on foreign products. So if you were to balance your trade, just balancing our trade will create 5 million new manufacturing jobs, just balancing the trade.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very easy to do that. So that would be one thing that I would do.
By going back to a tariff-based system, or
no? I'm not going the route of tariffs. I know those are almost impossible in the economy we have. Plus, we are members of WTO and so on.
Right.
I'm just saying, let's have free trade, but with a free trade in balance. And there are many ways to do. But there are two ways to bring this about. Without imposing any tariffs, and they are both within the veto of the president. You don't even need Congress for this. One is, which is a very simple one. Many times in the past, when a country had a trade deficit, they would impose quality controls on the products coming from surplus nations. I mean, did you get what I said?
Yeah, although your microphone is a little far away from your mouth, so you're fading in and out. But it sounds like what you're suggesting is that by regulating trade that we can do this rather than by taxing trade.
We are not going to place any restriction or through tariffs or other things. We could just say, and this has been done quite often in the past by countries that were having deficit problems, they would simply impose higher quality standards for goods coming from the nations which had trade surplus with them.
Right.
So we can say, all right, we need better quality from cameras coming from you or cars coming from you. And you can do the same thing on our products. We don't mind. We just want to have our standards upheld and those countries which keep having surplus with us, we just have an excuse to reduce their imports from them.
Right. But how do you do that when, I mean, you know, most of what's in an iPhone, for example, is actually made in Germany and is a fairly high-quality stuff. Japanese imports are quite high-quality products. I mean, 30 years ago, the stuff was junk, but it's not anymore.
Well, as I said, it's not that they are necessarily of bad quality. You are just using an excuse because you want to balance your trade, and you don't want to use tariffs because they are illegal.
Right.
And so this is just an excuse to reduce imports from nations that have huge trade surpluses with us. Germany is not a problem. China is, South Korea, a lot of Asian nations have huge trade surpluses with us, and some of their quality is not up to par any also. So the president can do it himself because there are bodies under his control, like we have this Food and Drug Administration.
Uh-huh.
They regulate the import of food from many nations. If food is not good, then they will say, we can't take it.
Right.
So in the same way, we can regulate the import of some manufactured goods and impose higher standards on goods from those countries that have high trade surpluses with us. And this was done quite often in the past when a country had balance of trade problems. That's one thing we can do, and that's a very simple thing to do. And another thing is that we can have two types of exchange rates, one for our exports and the other for our imports. For this, the Federal Reserve is needed to do. Like China is accumulating our currency, and they keep their currency cheap so they can export a lot to us. So
right.
Our Federal Reserve can buy their currency and keep our exchange rate low relative to the Chinese currency and reduce the prices of our exports to China.
So by monetary policy, basically.
Yeah, exactly. That's why the Federal Reserve It should come in.
Right.
In this case, this will be a dual exchange rate, and again, it has been tried by many nations, including, by the way, Germany,
sure.
Right after the Second World War, because they had also at that time big balance of trade problems, and they tried this. Italy has done this. India did it for many years.
Very interesting.
China is doing it right now.
Hang on just a second, sir. We will continue with more with Dr. Ravi Batra in just a moment.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Check out his latest book, The New Golden Age, also Greenspan's Fraud. His website, Ravi Batra, RAVIBATRA.com. We'll be back with Dr. Batra. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Dr. Batra, you're still on the line with us?
Yes.
Okay, great. So what about the doing, my understanding is that Germany does this probably better than anybody else, imposing a value-added tax at every stage along the way of manufacture in the United States, And then on export, reversing it out, which is basically a negative, you know, 15-20% tariff. And on imports, that because there's no VAT tax added to them, adding it at entry, which is functionally an import tariff. And the spread between the two could be as high as 30-some-odd percent. What about that?
Well, certainly, because with that, and that's not illegal at all, according to the WTO rules. But this would require new legislation. And yeah. I want to write a book in which you can bypass Congress and say, we don't even need you, and we can end unemployment in 2 years without going through Congress. So there are a lot of things the president can do himself, and he is beginning to do that. For instance, he is going to raise the minimum wage for any government work used by contractors. So if the rise in the minimum wage will increase consumer demand right away, and that would be very helpful in increasing demand and hence production and hence employment. The minimum wage is now close to what it was. It's now almost at the lowest in 30 years because prices have been rising and minimum wage has not kept up with them.
Right.
So the purpose of my book is simply to show that how we can end unemployment without new legislation, and the president and the federalism alone can do the job.
It's a remarkable idea that just the executive branch and the Fed could end unemployment. The Fed has two mandates. One is to reduce or keep low inflation. The other is to keep low unemployment. Do you think, have you seen any indication that that your suggestions are being seriously considered by folks in either the White House or over at the Fed?
Well, there is so much politics everywhere. I mean, I about a year or two ago, I talked to Nancy Pelosi about my ideas, and she was so excited. She was going to call Ben Bernanke the same day.
Yeah.
She tried, but it didn't go anywhere. So that's why I decided to write a book on it and show and address directly and show it to the Mr. President, to our president, that it can be done very easily without having to go through Congress. And I'm sure if he doesn't have to go through Congress, he would love it.
Yeah. Well, and that's the big problem he has, is anything
that's
has to go through, yeah, anything has to go through Congress, the Republicans are trying to block because they want his presidency to be a failed presidency.
And that's right. They can't end it now, but they want him to fail, yeah. So,
yeah.
So nobody or no black again tries to become a president. I think something like that may be behind it.
I think that the racist part of the Republican Party now with Clive and Bundy and whatnot, yeah, we're starting to see it even, you know, visibly. But certainly it's a big piece of it. Dr. Robbie Batra, we'll be right back in just a minute. It's 20 minutes past the hour. And be sure to check out Dr. Batra's website, robbiebatra.com. We'll be right back. Talking with Dr. Robbie Batra, an economist, professor of economics at Southern Methodist University, SMU, international best-selling author of The New Golden Age, The Coming Revolution Against Political Corruption and Economic Chaos, and Greenspan's Fraud, How Two Decades of His Policies Have Undermined the Global Economy. His website, robbiebatra.com. He's working on a book on how we can end unemployment in 2 years in the United States. We've talked in the past, sir, about just kind of basic economics, a basic understanding of how our economy works and how most Americans don't understand the economy. And they hear these talking points about, oh, we all, you know, the number one priority should be reducing government spending. And that's the best way to cut the debt. And cutting the debt is more important than dealing with the trade deficit and blah, de, blah, de, blah. Now, I'm wondering if you could just kind of give us a intro to macroeconomics and intro, you know, how does the economy actually work?
First of all, if we create many jobs, a lot of jobs, that itself would sharply reduce the budget deficit.
Right.
The question is, what should come first, the reduction of jobs or the reduction of the deficit? And I think it should be the job reduction. And I suggested two ways in which we can do it, balancing trade. There is another way we can also help the job market, and that is by bringing the price of oil down. And that can be also done very easily by the president himself. If we were to end speculation in the market, in the oil market, and that can be done by just simply increasing the margin requirements for oil speculation from the current 6% to 50%, which is the requirement to speculate in stocks, and shares. So if we apply the same requirement to the oil market, then, you know, speculation will end overnight, and overnight the price of oil will sharply go down. And that is very important to increase jobs in the economy, because as oil goes up, it's like a tax on the consumer.
So that's interesting. Speculation being a big problem. Can you talk about inflation? I had somebody call yesterday and they said, you know, why do we have so much inflation in the 70s? And I said that my understanding was that it was caused by a shortage of a basic commodity, oil, which drove price to oil, and that echoed through the economy. It wasn't that, you know, Richard Nixon or Jimmy Carter went on a binge of printing extra money. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Well, actually, it was initially done. It happened initially because the oil shot up almost 500% or so. But then they printed a lot of money to fight this very bad recession in the 1970s. And at that time, see, if you to find an answer for any question in economics, just look at supply and demand. So if supply does not rise much, but demand does, then prices will keep rising. And that's what happened in the 1970s. Supply fell sharply because of the rise in the price of oil, and demand, they supported demand by printing a lot of money. So demand was ahead of supply, and so prices keep rising. This time around, supply is not a problem. It's not a problem because China is ready to supply as much as we want from them, and they will lend us money to buy their goods. So this time supply is not a problem, and we are printing a lot of money to support the economy, but there's no inflation. The reason being, first of all, there's not enough demand, and secondly, supply is plentiful. So always look at supply and demand to answer any question in economics. And so when printing money sometimes will create inflation, then you can't increase supply. But right now, the whole world wants to send goods to the United States. So supply is not a problem. Demand is low, so inflation is not occurring. But that doesn't mean there is no inflation in the economy, and it's not hurting us. Money has to go somewhere. Whatever they are printing, it has to go somewhere. It's going into asset markets. So it's causing asset inflation, not the CPI inflation.
Right.
So the asset inflation, like in terms of huge price of oil, jump in gold price, jump in the price of raw materials like aluminum, copper, and because of all that
and the stock
rise
market.
In price, also the recession is not ending.
Right. And the stock market is going up too. Is all of this just funny money? Is this?
Most of it is, all of it is funny money, because the stock market has no business rising in an economy where you have just 2% growth. That's the trouble, you know. The growth is so low, and all the government money and the Federal Reserve money is going into these commodities in the stock market. And in the past, recession would end in two ways. One was the prices of raw materials would come down sharply. So as costs came down, businesses could easily increase output and hence hire people. Now those costs are not going down. Oil is at $100 per barrel. Look at the shallow recession of 1997. That shallow recession brought the price of oil down to $10 per barrel. Now we have the worst since the Great Depression, and the price is $100 per barrel. So how can this employment recession, or how can it can really end when these raw materials are not getting cheaper at all? Things that support an economy are not there. All we are doing is printing money, and the money is creating inflation, if not in CPI, elsewhere.
Yeah. So are you predicting a crash?
I think crash is bound to happen, whether this year or next year. It is going to happen because any little thing can go wrong, and the house of cards will come down again because we have another stock market bubble.
Right. Okay. Well, let's after the break talk about that crash, what it might look like, how people might protect themselves, and what politically we should be doing about it. We're talking with Dr. Ravi Batra at RaviBatra.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
His website, RaviBatra.com, his most recent best-selling books, The New Golden Age and Greenspan's Fraud. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Dr. Ravi Batra. Just hang on just a second here. I got to close a window. And Dr. Ravi Batra on the line with us, economist and professor of economics at Southern Methodist University, international best-selling author of The New Golden Age, The Coming Revolution Against Political Corruption and Economic Chaos, and Greenspan's Fraud, How Two Decades of His Policies Have Undermined the Global Economy. Dr. Batra, welcome back.
Thank you.
It's great having you with us. So we were talking just before the break about the possibility that, or the probability of a crash, that this economy is built on bubble gum and baling wire. How might this play out in your mind, in your opinion? What should we be looking for? What are the things that would be early warning indicators that a crash might happen? And how could the average person who has, you know, their retirement in a 401k or something, protect themselves against these kinds of economic disasters? I know, you know, rich people have hedge fund managers, and they love crashes because they can buy at the bottom and ride them all the way up. But the average person seems to get screwed. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, the thing is that the economy is very unstable. It's running on debt, consumer debt, government debt. It's running on debt. And there is not much consumer demand and even investment. So when an economy is very unstable, any shock to it can really send it into a crash. Like, for instance, now Putin is creating trouble with Ukraine. Right? If it gets out of hand even slightly more, there could be a crash. That's the whole trouble, because there's so much leveraging out there. After all, when the stocks are rising like that in a bad economy, it means that a lot of people are borrowing money and investing it in stocks. And any little crash can just boomerang, because then there will be margin calls. As the investors meet margin calls, there is bigger fall in stock prices, and on it can go. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't be surprised if there's a crash again by the end of this year. And it's also 7 years from the recession in 2007, and there is normally a 7-year cycle. And if things have not been fixed in those 7 years, then the next 7 years can be awful. Mm-hmm. So that could happen too, you know. So we could go into a very bad recession again, because we have wasted our resources all these years and have not introduced any meaningful economic reform.
Yeah. For years, I've subscribed to an investment newsletter. It's put out by the Aiden sisters, the Aiden Forecast. And, long ago, they were saying, you know, we're now in a commodity explosion, you know, get into gold and things. And then they said, now the stock market's going to go up, start getting into the stock market. And more recently, they've been saying, get out of the stock market. And I'm badly generalizing, and I don't mean to be speaking on their behalf. Let me take it out of the context of the Aiden Forecast and just say, you know, I read a bunch of different investment sites, and many of them are saying the same thing. move into things like government bonds, like TLT, like bond funds, move into things like the German mark or the British pound, put a quarter of your money into U.S. dollars, just into cash, and only keep a small amount of money in the U.S. stock market, because as much as it may go up, it is definitely going to go down at some point. I realize you're not an investment advisor, but does that sort of strategy make sense to you?
I think so, because you want to be in risky assets only when you have a sound economy. And the economy is wobbly. Any little thing can really set it on fire. So, and it's purely running again on debt. So I would not take risks with my money, especially if it is retirement money, like 401k plans. Like, remember what happened last time. So it could be worse than that, because we have wasted so many resources. At least last time we could increase our spending sharply. Government spending could go up sharply and fight it somewhat. This time we don't have that defense left. How can you increase your deficit even more when the debt is running at $17 trillion now?
Right. And the reason why we don't have that option is largely a political one, or an economic one, or both?
It's both, because we have used up all those resources. How can you bring down interest rates anymore?
Right.
I mean, that was one way to fight recession,
yeah,
to bring the interest rates down. I mean, you can't bring them down anymore. So we have used up all our options, and oil price still remains high. Suppose you have really bad tensions between Ukraine and Russia. Oil could go up even further.
Sure.
That itself could cause it.
Yeah, especially since about a third of the gas that goes to Europe is coming from Russia across Ukraine. In terms of some possible solutions and playing just, you know, with general ideas, I wrote an op-ed yesterday for we did it as a daily take, and it's published over at Truthout, pointing out that Germany, France, Sweden, there's actually about a dozen countries in the world right now that have guaranteed minimum incomes. Most of them are fairly small. They're in the U.S. dollars, they would be on the order of, you know, $2,000 to $12,000 a year. Switzerland is voting on $36,000 a year as a guaranteed minimum income. It's, you know, almost certainly going to fail. Alaska, since 1976, has had a guaranteed minimum income. It averages around $2,000 per person. So a family of five gets $10,000 a year, three kids, mom and dad, minimum. And what this does is it reduces poverty, it increases demand, it provides a stepping off point for people who want to be entrepreneurs. When you combine it with a national health care system, it really liberates people who want to be entrepreneurial and stimulates the economy. Do you, in your opinion, is the idea, and Thomas Paine, of course, was the first to propose this in his book Agrarian Justice back in the 1780s, is a minimum guaranteed income a good idea or a bad idea?
Well, this will be a great idea in the context of the United States, but not with Europe. They have too many such ideas, such things. Like they're guaranteed in Germany, for somebody who's laid off, is guaranteed 2 years of pay at 80% rate. And so a lot of people then shirk work, and that's why historically the unemployment rate in Europe is much even higher than that in the U.S., because a lot of people simply just don't want to work as they get so much benefit, so many benefits from the state. So, see, in the United States, the minimum wage is far below labor productivity. So here it would work like magic. But because productivity and wages have to be in certain proportion to have a high level of employment.
Right.
If you have time, I could give you the logic behind that. Because you want a balance between supply and demand, mm-hmm, and the main source of supply is productivity. Wages are the main source of demand. So if you want a balance between supply and demand, which is what we need to have a lot of jobs, then wages have to be very close to labor productivity. which is the case already in Europe. So if you were to increase that wage rate even more, there could be problems.
Right,
whereas in the U.S., this idea will work wonderfully.
Yeah, in the United States, we had some productivity and wages tracking each other for most of 200 years, but starting in the 1980s, I would say with Reaganomics, I'm not sure what you would identify as the cause of it, but Reagan's war on labor, we saw this decoupling, and labor price, the price of labor, wages have flattened since 1980, and yet productivity has continued to rise at the same rate it was during the previous 50 years.
Exactly. That's what's happening. With rising productivity, supply keeps rising, but with wages stagnant, demand is not rising at all, so then the government has to step in to spend money to create artificial demand. And also consumers, they induce consumers to borrow money through low interest rates, so consumer borrowing may create artificial demand. And this way they have been maintaining balance, but now even that balance is not being maintained properly. So wages have to be in a certain proportion to productivity. In the United States, this would be a great idea.
Yeah. So because our wages have been flat for 30 years, the demand has not been growing, except that it grew through using credit. We've got $1 trillion in student loan debt, almost $1 trillion in credit card debt. And then it also grew through government spending, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars a year, particularly in military spending, Iraq war, Afghanistan war, trillions of dollars in demand. But these are artificial ways of doing it. So what we need to do is go back to seeing our wages go up. Is that the essence of what you're saying?
We have to follow policies, market-oriented policies, that automatically raise wages when productivity goes up. This is not just a question of fairness. I mean, if you become more productive, educate yourself, you expect higher wages.
Right.
It's not just a matter of fairness. It's also a matter of sound economic policy. Because if there is supply ahead of demand, that means there's overproduction, and overproduction always causes layoffs.
Right. And the layoffs then produce this long-term unemployment that we have. We're talking with Dr. Ravi Batra. We'll be back in just a moment. His website is ravibatra.com. He's the author of, most recently, The New Golden Age and Greenspan's Fraud. His website is Ravi Batra, R-A-V-I-B-A-T-R-A, professoreconomics.com, professor of economics at Southern Methodist University. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And be sure to check out Dr. Batra's website over at RobbieBatra.com. Welcome back. And Dr. Batra, I mean, perhaps this is a political question, and if you think so and it's not your area of expertise or you don't want to comment on it, feel free. But I'm just wondering, how is it that we have had flat wages for 30 years while we've had rising productivity, and the American workers know something's wrong? Why has there not been a discussion of this in the larger media? Why is this common sense stuff that you're talking about, economically, supply and demand, wages and productivity, why is it not being discussed? And how did this whole supply side thing, gee, if we jack up supply, if we increase productivity, we can flatten wages, demand is irrelevant, that was pitched during the Reagan administration. How did that take hold, and how is it still alive 33 years later?
Well, that's because the wealthy control politics. They control everything in society. There's a lot of corruption in Congress. And so nothing gets done unless things are desperate. And things were desperate in 2008 and 2009, and the president lost a great opportunity to do something really, to introduce some real reforms. Now things are not that desperate. With all that credit boom, government spending of money, okay, things are plodding along. But I think they're going to get desperate again, and then some real reforms will be introduced.
Yeah, well, that's the essence of the argument that you make in your book, The New Golden Age, isn't it?
That's right. That's exactly. And remember, in that book I had written that a deep recession would start by the end of 2007, and then it would go on and on. Either we are stuck at the bottom or it gets worse, but we won't come out of it unless we have genuine economic reforms. And that's what has happened ever since then.
Yeah. Do you think that genuine economic reform can be driven through this political system, or is this going to take a populist revolt?
Well, that's the essence of this new book. I don't think the president is the problem. He has his heart is at light. He has had bad advisors, and of course Congress is not cooperating. So that's why I want to show him through this book, new book, that you can do it all by yourself, completely bypass Congress. Even the Federal Reserve can be bypassed, and he can do it all alone because there are agencies under his control that can bring down the price of oil, that can bring down the interest rates to the consumer. You know, the banks are still charging 15% interest rate on their credit card loans, whereas they are paying 0% to the Federal Reserve for money they get. But the president on his own can do something to bring these down, rates down. I will show it all in this new book, and we don't need Congress. So I think we can do something about this unemployment in a hurry.
Yeah. When do you expect your new book's going to be out?
In 2 or 3 months. I'm about to finish it soon, and then in 2 or 3 months it should be out.
If
the publisher says that, sometimes these publishers say, well, they take minimum 6 months, then I will publish it on my own and bring it out very quickly, because I think it should be out before the congressional elections.
Yeah.
And let the people see what can be done.
I agree. When it comes out, come back on this program and we will promote it. Can you hold on just a minute?
Sure.
We'll be right back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. We're talking with Professor Ravi Batra, Southern Methodist University professor of economics and author of The New Golden Age and Greenspan's Fraud. RaviBatra.com is websites. We'll be right back. Here with you. We're talking with Dr. Ravi Batra, professor of economics at SMU and internationally best-selling author of The New Golden Age and Greenspan's Fraud. And Dr. Batra, in my new book, The Crash of 2016, I quote you and credit you talking about the supply and demand issue. I went down a slightly different road, though. I pointed out how in 1971 you had this fellow, Lewis Powell, who ultimately ended up on the Supreme Court, publishing this memo to business leaders saying, we've got to get politically active. You know, Ralph Nader and Rachel Carlson represent a huge threat to us, an existential threat to us. Business has to become politically active. And the political activity of business has, you know, in many ways brought us to, you know, Dr. Batra is calling back right now. Okay. If you can hear me, sir, we can talk on Skype, perhaps. No, he can't. Okay, he's going to call us right back. So anyway, where I was going with that is that it seems to me that there is a political dimension to this as well as there is an economic dimension to it, and I think it's really important that we consider both, you know. We consider both the political dimension and the economic dimension. He's still dialing in? Yeah. Oh, we're dialing him. Okay, fine. Dr. Batra has just some, you know, solid common sense thoughts on this stuff. Here we go. Dr. Batra, welcome back.
Yes, thank
my
you.
My apologies. I was talking about there being a that prior to the 1970s, business was not involved in politics. And since the 1970s, business has inserted itself into politics in a very big way since the Powell memo. And now we have billionaires buying politicians. We have politicians going to Las Vegas to kiss the ring of a billionaire, hoping that he will fund their nomination for president of the United States, those kinds of situations. How do we change a political system, how do we change an economic system that has been so corrupted by a political system, particularly when the Supreme Court keeps saying that money is, you know, that George Washington fought the Revolutionary War to protect the billionaires, that money is somehow buried somewhere in the First Amendment?
I think it will have to be done at the ballot box. I think if the the genuine economic reforms are not introduced, then we'll have to muddle through where we are. And I don't think the American electorate will take that forever. They would not want to live on unemployment benefits, which even now are not being extended. So I think a revolution would occur.
Yeah.
And by the way, I have made four or five different forecasts of revolutions. My economic forecasts sometimes have been wrong, but not the forecast about a revolution. And that's what I'm predicting. In the new golden age, the revolution is coming within this decade.
Yeah. From your lips to God's ears, I sure hope you are right and would love to see it and even be part of it. What are your thoughts on the European Union? Do you think it's going to hold together?
Yeah, it will hold together. They will hold together, no doubt.
I was in Germany last weekend, and I was reading in the Financial Times that the former Eastern European countries who are now members of the EU, that they have right now their debt payment this year is over $130 billion, which is more than 30% of their GDP. How can a country do that?
Well, that's what I said. There are so many contradictions in this global economic system. Any little thing, any little spark can set it on fire. So sometime this decade, there will be a revolution all over the world.
So it could be that Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland defaulting on debt. Even much smaller economies than, for example, Greece or Spain, which could also, presumably default on debt, that something like that could be the trigger that produces a worldwide depression.
That's right. And we certainly can't forecast what that trigger would be, but it has to come because there are those seven. My forecasts have been quite often based on these seven-year cycles. And one pattern I've seen in nature is that if there is a problem, and you have been given 7 years to fix it. If you don't fix it, then there is a very big collapse after that.
Yeah. That's almost that's biblical. I mean, that's leave the fields fallow every 7 years. That's remarkable. So, with regard to the United States trade policies with the rest of the world, the president now is trying to have this. I call it SHAFTA, the Southern Hemisphere Asian Free Trade Agreement. He calls it the Trans-Pacific Partnership. But he's trying to get this new trade deal through. And the minute we have left, I'm curious your thoughts on TPP or SHAFTA.
Crazy. It is just crazy. If you want trade deals, have them with high-wage nations, not with low-wage nations. They would destroy our wages even more.
So if we have a trade deal with Germany, it brings up our wages, but if we have a trade deal with Vietnam, it drags down our wages.
That's right. Free trade should be with the same nations that have nations with the same kind of wage structure.
And presumably environmental protections and labor standards and those kind of things?
Those other things, yes. They will count too.
Yeah. If the president gets TPP, there are people who are predicting it's going to pass in the middle of the night, could that be a trigger to provoke a crash?
I can't predict what a trigger would be. There are so many things that could go wrong.
You're right. Dr. Ravi Batra, it's always great talking with you, sir. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks a lot.
Dr. Ravi Batra, his website, ravibatra.com, and his most recent book, The New Golden Age. Prior to that, Greenspan's Fraud. Brilliant reading.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com. Your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, So please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. And thanks to Dr. Boucher for that, for spending an hour with us and talking about all dimensions of economics. I think that, you know, we covered a lot of territory there. His audio was not the world's best. My apologies to you for that. In the past, he had a wired landline. This was trying to do it with a cell phone. I think, you know, before we do it again, we'll make sure that we get the audio cleaned up a little bit. Anyhow, it is Friday. It's Anything Goes Friday, so we'll just pick up your comments on pretty much any topic that you want to talk about. Obviously, there's a bunch of stuff in the news. The FCC trying to end net neutrality. You can call them and leave your opinion over at 202-418-1000. And you can sign the petition at freepress.net. And a great place to start, freepress.net. And I strongly encourage you to, you know, here we have, you know, former lobbyist for the internet industry now running the FCC. And surprise, surprise, he wants to change the rules so the internet industry can make a whole lot more money. This is just wrong. So I called this morning. I called 202-418-1000. And instead of getting a human being, I got a voice that said, Office of Tom Wheeler, Chairman, leave your message. And so the message I left was, hi, my name is Tom Hartmann. I'm a citizen of and a taxpayer and a registered voter. I live here in Washington, D.C. Here's my address and zip code. And I just want the commissioner to know, the chairman to know, that I believe that the Internet should be declared a common carrier. And that he, and I know that he can do this with a simple proclamation, essentially, and I want to encourage him to do that. Period. Very simple. So that was my good deed for the day, and I would encourage you to do the same thing. The Haas v. Romney racketeering lawsuit is moving on. Mitt Romney, this guy, Mr. Haas, is alleging that Romney left Bain Capital to avoid being prosecuted. And that there's a RICO thing coming down the road. We'll see how this thing plays out. I think it's fascinating. And he's posting over Democratic Underground under Laser Haas, H-A-A-S, L-A-S-E-R, H-A-A-S. And, you know, the president is in Asia. There's been some breakthroughs. Maybe Japan will get on board with the TPP. That would be a disaster, in my opinion, but we'll see where that goes. So, you know, step by step. And Ravi Batra predicting a political revolution. I am, too. I think American people are fed up. I think, you know, the rights, you know, these guys showing up with guns to help out Clive and Bundy, and there's many of them are still there, by the way. And the Occupy movement has reoccupied Zuccotti Park. They're getting virtually no publicity, but it's happening right now in New York City. These are symptoms of America saying enough already. And I think we're going to see a revolt at the ballot box in 2014, and I think we're going to see some real significant political change coming along. But it's not going to happen unless we all get involved. So anyhow, Anything Goes Friday. Let's go to your calls here. We've got a full board of calls. Jason in Arlington, Virginia. Hey, Jason, you wanted to
talk about? Hey, I wanted to comment about we had Earth Day, and I didn't hear a single person out there talking about how ethanol mandates by the government have destroyed incredible amounts of topsoil, water, just the driving the price of food higher when we have 48 million people on food stamps. It turns out the best investment you could have made for your money over the last 15 years is actually buying Iowa farmland.
Yeah, well, you know, your point is well taken. You're right. It's also the main song that the fossil fuel industry is singing. And so for all I know, you're a paid lobbyist. I mean, I'm watching these ads right now. The ethanol industry is running ads saying, you know, it's the cleanest fuel out there. You got to, you know, keep the price supports going. You know, the ethanol industry is sucking at the whatever of government, and so is the oil industry. In my mind, a pox on both their houses. Tom, in Kalkaska, Michigan. Hey, Tom, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, I was thinking about, we've been so successful changing the names of different things, like bribery to lobbying, and, you know, the interest into fees. Why couldn't we just change the name of free trade to fair trade? And,
well,
you know, I've kind of missed my my time to talk to Robbie there. So I was just wondering what your reaction would be to.
Well,
that.
I guarantee you, Ravi Batra would support that, and well, I can't guarantee it, but I believe he would, and I certainly do. And in fact, one of the things that, if you look at the language that's been coming out of largely Democrats for years, is let's have fair trade rather than free trade, and there's a big difference between the two. And as Ravi Batra pointed out, if you're going to have a trade agreement with a country, make sure that it's a country that has higher wages and better standards than yours, not lower wages. You will benefit from that. If it's a country that has lower wages, they will benefit from it. All you have to do is look at what, you know, what's happened with us having trade agreements with China and Vietnam and all these other countries that are now. I mean, there's more people now in the Chinese middle class than there are American citizens. And yet 50 million American citizens have slid out of the middle class and into poverty. And I lay a lot of the blame for this directly at the feet of our insane trade deals. There's a great website on this, Economy in Crisis. I think it's .org, it might be .com, but the Economy in Crisis blog website has been doing a great job of documenting this in a fairly bipartisan fashion, frankly. I'm with you, Tom. Ashes in Chicago, listen to WCPT. Hey, what's up, Ashes?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, I agreed with Dr. Batra that this is a stagnant recovery. I don't feel like it's a real recovery like all the recoveries have been after recessions. I want to talk to you about wages. I was talking to my friend who I go to college with, and he's studying to be a mechanic right now, mm-hmm. a car auto mechanic. And he's talking to he just finished school to become a mechanic. Now he's going into these dealerships that hire mechanics, and they say, he said that the starting salary to start as a mechanic now is like $12 an hour. And don't you think that's a little too low for a car mechanic to be working, to starting out as?
Yeah, I think that should be basically an entry-level wage, or, you know, for somebody who has.
This is a skill that not a lot of people have, you know, fixing cars. And it started at $12 an hour. I think that's just an insult to the people who want to enter that industry.
Yeah, the one exception I would make to that, and this is just, you know, anecdotal, and it may be nonsense or it might be spot on, but my dad worked in a tool and die shop for 40 years, and I used to go down and hang out when I was a kid, and you know, they'd sit around at lunchtime playing pinochle and shooting the breeze, and got to know a lot of these guys. And my brother actually, for a while, one of my brothers thought he was going to be a tool and die maker and got a job there. And you started out with, you know, some basic skills, but you started out basically at something close to a little over minimum wage, but you started out with a fairly low wage. And then the union and the guys, you know, working there over the course, it took a couple of years to become a journeyman. You know, you start out as an apprentice and at fairly low pay, but there was a fairly rapid path, a year, 2 years, 3 years, to becoming a journeyman tool and die maker. And at that point, then you qualified for full union benefits and you know, a reasonable wage, which, you know, would probably be in today's dollars the equivalent of $60,000 or $70,000 a year, and you know, entry into the middle class. So I wouldn't be horrified by an entry level wage as a car mechanic at $12 if, you know, within a year or two, if they were any good, they could be making $20 or $25 an hour. Or whatever, you know, 18, you know, some reasonable livable wage. But if it's going from $12 an hour up to $13 an hour over the next 5 years, that's a disaster. So anyhow, those are my thoughts on that. Ashes, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Cliven Bundy's daughter has now come out and said, Sean Hannity is more interested in his ratings than in my dad. Gee, you think? And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Susan in Wauna, Washington. Hey, Susan, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. What's up?
Well, as I've said before, I think the Great Depression has already started. And the initial was to make people suffer and hurt, which happened, you know, this past Christmas when they cut off benefits. But when I've spoke to the White House, the call line that actually takes a paragraph, which is 202-456-1414, and you have a very intelligent listening audience, so hopefully they take down that number. It's not Michael Moore's 1111. It's 456-1414. The trade agreements, TTP and TIP, are already done. Net neutrality is done. Fracking is done. You can call John Hoeven's office. He's one of the House reps that's expanding that whole thing. California is lacking water due to fracking, and that's going to affect all of us because then the price of produce will go up tremendously. The trans-Canadian thing is also done. That's another reason to call John Hoeven's office, is because he wants that too. It's like, part of it is that we owe China so much. It's like we need to just bend over and keep taking it from China. And, you know, they've gone from suffering and hurt to misery and hopelessness. I mean, I'm sitting on nearly $6,000, and I can't find a place that will even rent to me.
Hmm.
And that's prepaying like 4 months out.
Yeah.
I don't know if you happened to catch the C-SPAN when Louis Gohmert was inventing a new word. He used the word, and you'll have to go back over C-SPAN, but it was immoral. But rather than just leave it as immoral, he used a banking term of amateurization. So it was immoral amateurization.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, you had the guy on the other day. The Russian war is already beginning. And then we have Kerry on the TV, you know, sitting there saying, you know, that's naughty that, you know, the Russians did this or that. And, I mean, that's only digging our spurs in deeper of, you know, and why we have this whole buildup and dedication to Israel or to the people in Crimea of giving them, you know, X, Y, Z amount of money. I mean, we have people here that cannot get help from our own social systems, and it wasn't just since Barack Obama came in. There has been this lotto of trying to get Section 8 or subsidized housing that it can last anywhere from 6 years, 8 years, out to 15 years. There was a guy on C-SPAN this morning from the inner city parts of, I forget if it was Chicago or if it was out of Wisconsin. His name was Robert Woodson. And I mean, the guy's sitting there smirking every time he says something ugly of how, again, we're making people go from being suffering and hurt to misery and hopelessness. And it just reminds me of, like, that cartoon of Nightmare Before Christmas when the mayor comes to visit Jack, and the mayor's head keeps spinning around, and Jack's kind of looking at him in awe and says, you know, I can't make any decisions on my own, Jack. I'm just an elected official. And, I mean, that's what these people do. You had the comment the other day about Tim Wheeler. And again, that's a situation that Obama created. That's why I keep saying, and you keep blanking me out, that both sides are guilty, the Democrats and Republicans.
They are. They are. Both sides are bought and paid for. The Republicans worse than the Democrats, but Democrats too. Absolutely. There are some good Democrats out there. Sherrod Brown is out there, Jan Schakowsky, Keith Ellison. You've got a bunch of good Democrats, but they end up, thank you, Susan, for your call, they end up in safe districts. So they're kind of tolerated by Republicans. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Anything Goes Friday. Amy, listening on Cable Radio Network. Hey, Amy, you're up. You're on the air.
I want to make an observation about Clive on Monday, because no one seems to... he didn't just insult black people. I think that's what he was doing. He was out, you know, he just didn't have, he wasn't out of his mind and insane. He was trying to insult black people, but he also insulted white people. And nobody seems to be picking up on that.
You mean white people who are on welfare?
No, he just said that, you know, the ideal American citizen is one that works hard and is family oriented. And he said that Mexicans were better than white people and they deserve to be here.
Huh, I missed that. Interesting.
Yeah, you said that.
Yeah, I have not hung on every word Cliven Bundy said in the last 24 hours. I probably should have. He's apparently been making news. Amy, thanks for the heads up on that, and thanks for listening in North Las Vegas. Morris in Long Beach, California, listening on KPFK. Hey, Morris, what's up?
Good afternoon, Professor. First, I want to say thank you for giving Dr. Stephen Cohen the other day some very good time. I consider Mr. Cohen to be a scholar.
He is.
My question to you, sir, is does the Postal Service collective bargaining agreement allow them to strike?
I don't know the answer to the question. Are you talking about the protests that are occurring right now around Staples, where the post office and Staples are talking about putting post offices into Staples and having non-union, low-wage Staples workers do work that postal workers used to do?
I'm familiar with that, but my focus or my narrative is, can they strike? Can the Postal Service employees say, if that contract is not canceled with Staples within 60 days,
right,
no one's getting their mail? Are they allowed to do that? Because I don't have a background in this, but some folks are not allowed to strike.
I know. This is how Reagan busted the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization, PATCO. I believe that it's against the law for federal employees to strike. I don't know if there's a qualifier in there, like critical federal employees, but there is a law against many federal employees striking. It may be all, it may be just some. And whether the post office qualifies or falls into that category or not, I honestly don't know. We'll have to get a, next time I get a labor guy on, you know, like Robert Reich would be perfect for this, I'll ask the question, okay?
Appreciate you taking my call.
Thank you, Morris. I'm sorry I don't know the answer. It maybe somebody in the chat room can track it down for us. Wayne in Chicago. Hey, Wayne, what's up? Thanks for listening to WCPT.
Good afternoon, Tom. I want to thank you again for having Dr. Vautra on. Actually, I've been waiting for him to come back on, and I missed the first half an hour, but luckily CPT put you on again at the same time, only 12 hours later.
Oh, great.
So, that's great. So I'll be able to catch the first half. But anyway, Tom, my question is, actually I have two questions now. Has the doctor revised or updated his time frame for when he thinks there will be this collapse, economic collapse?
He said that things tend to go in seven-year cycles, that we are 7 years now into the recovery phase, as it were, of this economy, and therefore any day now, this year or next year, we should see a collapse. And that because we have not done, and this is essentially the same stuff that I say in the crash of 2016, because we have not repaired the systems, because we haven't done the work that we should have done back in 2008, 2009. I'm going to sneeze here in a second. Excuse me. Because we haven't put our economy back together in a way that is appropriate, because we still have insane trade policies, because the banksters still are cartelized and run 30% of our economy. Because manufacturing is still, you know, in the wrong place, because we're still conducting a war on organized labor. Because of these things, this crash will be worse than the last.
Right. Okay, Tom, here's another question. Okay, during the first depression that started October 29, okay, the value of the dollar did not depreciate. Is that correct?
Well, it depends on how you're defining it. Arguably, the value of the dollar went up. Because when you have deflation, which is what we had in from 1929 to 1934, when you have deflation, the value of the currency goes up, the price of the goods goes down, but nobody has any money, and because nobody has any money, there's no demand for goods and services, and that's why the price falls.
Okay, now do you think this next collapse, is the value of the dollar going to appreciate, depreciate, or stay about the same?
I think it's going to appreciate. I think this is going to be a deflationary collapse.
Okay. That's what I wanted to know. Okay, Tom, thank you.
And just to that point, Wayne, I'm seeing, I've raised this issue with Dr. Batra, that investment advisors that I follow are saying, if you have money, if you've got a retirement fund or whatever, put it in British pounds, put it in German marks, put it in U.S. dollars, put it into treasuries. These are all places where if the U.S. dollar, if there's a crash, if the stock market goes down, these are all going to go up. And they're all kind of counter-cyclical. So apropos of that. Wayne, thanks a lot for the call. Dan in Stockton, California. Just a minute to the break here at the bottom of the hour. Dan, a quick one, I hope.
Yeah, quick question. I just wanted to know how petroleum never came to be the basis of a currency like gold or silver or any of that.
Yeah, it's a good question. They're actually, some of the Middle Eastern emirates have suggested that. They have suggested currencies based on oil. I think one of the main reasons is because it's, A, so fungible. It's so easily transportable from place to place. The world market in oil is very much a world market, not so much like with oil. And B, we keep discovering more and more of it, and we keep discovering ways to need less and less of it, none of which can be said of precious metals. So probably that's why. Although, like I said, in the 70s, when there was a shortage of oil, we saw the dollar, the value of the dollar go down. We saw inflation because there was so much more demand for oil. So arguably the dollar is denominated in oil, and if we see an oil shock, expect a big problem, and that could come out of a mess in the Ukraine, for example. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
In fact, I think it's interesting that virtually every time Dr. Batra talked about how our economy could be easily tipped over, he mentioned Ukraine. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's funny. I was reading Andy Borowitz's blog, and, his most recent story is about, hang on a second here, I'm trying to get back into our screening software. Most recent blog was about how the Republicans are, Rand Paul's issuing a statement that, how dare Mr. Bundy not use accepted code words to talk about race. It's over the top. Or, Republicans are upset, people who don't like math, with the new Obamacare numbers, things like this. And you read his blog, and it's like, it could be Fox News. I mean, it's so bizarre. It's so bizarre. Anyhow, Mark in Elmwood Park, Illinois. Hey, Mark, what's on your mind? You want to talk about ecological configuration?
Oh, me?
Yes,
no,
sir.
Hi, Tom. Actually, this is about astrology. Anything Goes Friday, so I'll take you up.
Sure, yeah.
But apparently, a lot of astrologers are saying there's something in the sky called the Grand Cardinal Cross, where Jupiter, Uranus, Mars, Pluto all form a cross.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a 180-year cycle. And apparently we're at the very beginning of the 45-year cycle, the first quarter of the cycle, as I understand it. I'm not an astrologer. I'm just kind of learning about this as the last couple of days. But there seems to be big societal tectonic shifts that are in place that are beginning to get activated.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess it's like for all the Tom Hartman listeners, the change is coming.
Yeah.
If you will. We're finally getting a break.
Yeah. I don't know about the Grand Cross, and I'm not knowledgeable about astrology other than just freaking out every time Mercury goes retrograde. But it could be, Mark. It may well be. I actually believe there is something to astrology. I just don't know what it is. Thank you for the call. And for your comments. Vicki in Mondovi, Wisconsin, you wanted to talk about the FCC?
I did. I called the FCC yesterday when I was watching your program, and it took me about 8 minutes to connect with one of the technicians, and I said, my goodness, if you're in the communication field, you should really hire some more help so that you can receive your calls in a timely fashion. She said, I don't know what happened, she said, but lately, today, we've just been getting swamped with calls, and I decided to correlate that with your call for contacting the FCC, and I want to make you feel good about it.
Well, thank you. I can tell you from past experience where I've gotten feedback, both positive and negative, from members of Congress or from particular websites, that if I really hammer on something, and I don't think this is just unique to me, I'm guessing probably any show with the kind of audience we have could do the same thing, that we can brown out websites and we can bring down phone lines. I'm not trying to do either, but I do think that it's a good idea for people to go to freepress.net.
Well, it happen more often.
Yeah, I go to freepress.net and sign the petition and call the FCC. You can call Chairman Wheeler's office at 202-418-1000. And my simple message, and you can make whatever message you want. I give my audience, all of you, incredible credit for your own intelligence. But the way that I said it, and which maybe might not be the most elegant, but I said, you know, declare that that internet service providers are common carriers, that the internet is part of the commons, and that out of that comes everything else. Out of that comes net neutrality and everything else. So simply declare ISPs, internet service providers, as common carriers. That was my argument. Vicki, thanks a lot for the call. And thanks for calling the FCC. Thanks for being an activist. Good on you. Dean in La Centre, Washington. Hey, Dean, what's up?
Yeah, you were wondering what separated wages from productivity in the 80s?
Well, it was Reaganomics.
Yeah, they were brainwashing us because of inflation, double-digit inflation. And unions had cost of living contracts back then. We were making a dollar a year off cost of living plus 90 cents to a dollar and a half an hour off our wage increases.
Mm-hmm.
They said wages are cause of inflation.
Right.
And they broke us from productivity, getting it from there and tied it to inflation. So that's where it split.
You're absolutely right, and I had totally forgot that, and I lived through that era. In fact, I quoted Alan Greenspan in my book Screwed, and I didn't put that two to two together. Greenspan, back in the 90s, said to the Wall Street Journal that one of his most important jobs as chairman of the Fed, particularly in the 80s, was to maintain, whenever the economy started getting good, to raise interest rates and cool down the economy, to maintain what he called, quote, a certain minimum necessary level of worker insecurity. In other words, a certain, you know, you have to actually keep unemployment at a slightly higher level, not a slightly lower level, so that workers are less likely to go on strike. And so you don't have what Greenspan referred to as wage inflation. Now, he had no problem with CEO wage inflation, but average working people wage inflation. So you're right. They were using wage inflation they were blaming that as the boogeyman that was causing inflation, when actually it was merely reflecting it. And they were using that inflation scare to break all these union contracts and wring concessions out of unionized workers and reduce wages of non-unionized workers. You're absolutely right, Dean. Thank you for the reminder and the history lesson. Dina in Apache Junction, Arizona. What's up, Dina?
I want to thank you for being on, and you're a light. I was in the dark, and I knew the information wasn't correct, but I didn't know until I started watching you, so thank you. I want to talk about taxation without representation.
Mm-hmm.
The majority of us pay our taxes, and it's going to things we don't want it to go to. It's going to subsidies for the oil companies, for the commercial farmers, et cetera. And I have an idea. I don't know if it would be legal. I don't see why not. When you live in an apartment building and they don't follow through on what they're supposed to provide for you, like water and proper repairs, you can take your rent as a collective and put it in escrow until they repair the situation.
Depending on the state you live in, there are some state laws that allow that and others that don't. But, yeah, your point is well taken.
But couldn't we do that with our taxes? Couldn't we put it in escrow until they represented us? Isn't taxation without representation illegal?
It's not illegal. It was the rallying call for the American Revolutionary War. It is the law here in Washington, D.C. We have no representation in Congress whatsoever. Eleanor Holmes Norton speaks for us, but she's not allowed to vote. There's a whole long history behind that I think is actually kind of a cool history, but that's the reality. But I can tell you that back in the 80s, back in the 70s and 80s, there was a movement. Actually, it was back in the late 60s and through the early 70s, a movement of people who were opposed to the Vietnam War to not pay their income taxes. And it kind of bifurcated into two paths. There was an added tax that was put on our phone bills that was just for the war. And people withheld that from the phone company and didn't pay those. And they, by and large, did not get prosecuted for that. And I'm not sure if anybody ever followed up and forced collection or not. I was not one of the people who withheld my money from my phone bill. But I know that it was fairly commonly done. Then there were people who were withholding money from the IRS and putting it in escrow. And those people got squashed like a bug. So I'm pretty confident in saying. And by the way, we had an earlier caller who said, is it possible that the Postal Service employees can go on strike? They cannot. The 5 U.S. Code 7311, loyalty and striking, says that it is against the law. You cannot be a member may not accept or hold a position in the government of the United States or the government of the District of Columbia asserts the right to strike against the government of the United States or against the government of District of Columbia. But in any case, taxation without representation, there is, to the best of my knowledge, nothing in law that says that we have the right to representation with regard to taxation. That was just, you know, a revolutionary rallying cry. Dina, thanks for the call. Mark Taylor Canfield in Seattle, you have a report about the minimum wage, sir.
Yes, I do. There's the first ever national $15 an hour minimum wage conference happening in Seattle tomorrow. But first, Tom, I wanted to thank you for being such an independent voice on the air. And thanks for all the great, great guests lately, because your program's inspired a lot of dialogue and debate online. And I hear you're going to be in Seattle soon, so it'll be good to hear you talk about your book and some of these issues. Do you have any details for us on that?
Yeah, May 1st. I'll be at Town Hall at 7:30 p.m., and I look forward to meeting you there.
Great. Well, I just wrote about the $15 an hour national conference at my blog at Daily Coast. There's some really impressive speakers that are going to be at that event tomorrow, and people can go to 15now.org for details. But they've got Glenn Ford, who is a founding member of the Washington chapter of the National Association of Black Journalists, also from Black Agenda Report. They've also got David K. Johnston speaking, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author of Free Lunch, and David Goldstein, who's our local political commentator and blogger. But it's going to be a major event, and it's very important to our area because there's multi-billion-dollar corporate projects going on in Seattle right now. And the latest homeless count was in King County, Martin Luther King Jr. County. There's 3,123 people who have no shelter, many of whom, according to the homeless activists I talked to, are the working poor. They actually have jobs.
Amazing.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It is so wrong. Mark Taylor Canfield, you can read his blog over at DailyCos.com. Thanks, Mark.
Thanks, Tom. Keep up the good work.
You too. Good talking to you. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tammy, watching Free Speech TV in Spirit Lake, Iowa. Hey, Tammy, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Thanks again for taking my call.
Sure.
I called a few weeks back about Dad who wanted to get a gun because he was tired of living in the nursing home after his stroke. And I wanted to pass on that he passed away on Good Friday. He made his journey into the light. It was 8 years to the day that he had his original stroke. And he enjoyed playing pinochle as well.
Just like my dad.
It was nearly $500,000 for his care. He did have long-term insurance as well as a Cadillac policy prior to that. But, you know, they cut him off in 2006 after 90 days. And again, he had the same stroke as Gabby Giffords. So now that this chapter is closed, it just made me realize how many things there are to think about in the area of health care.
Yeah.
So, and one other thing. On my way there, the farms that used to dot the drive for me from the lakes area down to where Dad was are just disappearing at an incredible rate. The groves are just being torn down and burned, and the houses are moved or burned or I don't know what, but I hardly recognized the drive and didn't know where to turn.
This is in Iowa?
Yes.
Wait, are they turning into suburban housing or?
Rows and rows of genetically modified corn and soybeans.
Oh,
like,
okay.
It's where it used to be a grove and a farm and pigs and chickens and buildings and a barn, now it's just like a house with a few little trees stuck out there, if there's a house at all. Some of the farms are just completely disappearing.
Right, and they're being taken over by giant agriculture companies.
Yes. Yes. And, you know, then, you know, right after he died, you know, I had to leave and just run outside and drive around, and the smell and the stench of the pesticides that they were spraying in the air, I thought, oh, great, now I can get cancer after I just, you know, watched my father make his journey. So, and ironically enough, I didn't know it at the time, but he was buried on Earth Day. And the very next day, I returned to my little nick of the woods and listened to the radio, and there was Steve King on the radio talking about how much we need the Keystone XL pipeline. And I swear, Tom, he said that oil, even if oil spills into the aquifer there in Nebraska, you can, oil and water don't mix, as everyone knows, and you can just suck it right off the top. It's no environmental damage whatsoever. Now, I don't know if it's possible for you to get a copy of what he said, his words, on our local radio station.
Steve King used to come on our show all the time. You know, it's been a while since I've invited him on. Maybe we should just invite him back and say, did you really say this? Do you really believe this? And if so, I've got a glass of something for you to drink.
Exactly. And, you know, Tom, I wish you would, because I had Steve King come and meet my dad before the election last year to meet a voter whose insurance was cut off.
Yeah.
And ironically, that probably wouldn't happen to him now with Obamacare.
Right.
But I did tell Mr. King that I listened to your show, and I said, you know, I look forward to you going back on. And, you know, I told him how much I enjoyed it. So that would be wonderful.
Oh, good.
At least it would be very, very ugly.
Congressman King is always good for an interesting debate. One of the things I like about him is he actually tells the truth about what he believes. You know, he's politically incorrect, and and so people can really see the real Republican agenda, the real kind of royalist agenda. Tammy, thanks a lot for the call and my consolation on your father's passing. Yeah. 10 minutes before the hour, welcome back. Tom Harmon here with you, and let's check in with Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
Happy Friday.
And to you, too.
Thank you. So what's up?
Well, a lot of things are up today. Situation in Ukraine is not great. Number of things going on. There are allegations that pro-Russian separatists have seized a bus carrying international military observers, and that negotiations are going on for their release, according to Ukraine's Interior Ministry. Russia has accused the West of wanting to seize Ukraine. President Obama had a conference call with European leaders, and the U.S. is ready to impose more sanctions. S&P downgraded Russia to one notch above junk today. Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov described Ukrainian military raids on buildings occupied by separatists as a bloody crime. And Ukrainian Prime Minister Yatsenyuk accused Russia of wanting to start World War III. So,
yeah, we had Steve Cohen on this program for an hour on Tuesday or Wednesday this week. And his big concern was that during the last Cold War, that we have basically descended into a new Cold War. And during the last Cold War, after the Cuban Missile Crisis, Presidents Kennedy and Premier Khrushchev developed all these back channel ways to make sure that if their radar went nuts and they thought a missile strike had been launched or whatever, that there was communication. And I see the headline today over at the Daily Beast that 2 days ago, actually, the Obama administration, they didn't announce it, but it was reported in the New York Times, I guess on Saturday or Sunday, that they've stopped high-level communications with Russia. And then today I see that President Putin, says he's stopping high-level communications at the White House. This is not good.
No, you've got to have communication, as Winston Churchill did say, jaw, jaw, jaw is better than war, war, war.
Yeah, yeah. This could be a very, very bad situation.
Very
what else
bad
is going on in the world?
DNRA is having its annual gun fest, its annual convention, starting today.
Do they let people into the main hall with guns?
I think you can go anywhere. I mean, I don't know that, but I think that's part of the deal, you know.
Well, I think that was one of the great ironies, was that one of the recent NRA events that Wayne LaPierre was speaking at, that people had to go through metal detectors. You couldn't come in with a gun. They were afraid somebody might shoot him.
Oh. Awkward.
Yeah.
The NRA's chief lobbyist Chris Cox today called former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg an arrogant hypocrite and told him to stay out of our homes, stay out of our gun cabinet. Also commented on Bloomberg's new project, where Bloomberg's forming a new group called Every Town for Gun Safety that is going to encourage gun control advocates to punish elected officials who don't support stricter gun laws. And Cox got very fulminated, if you like, about that. Then Senator Mitch McConnell spoke and said that he would work to expand the rights of gun owners if he was given the opportunity to lead a new Senate majority, and gave them a speech full of red meat. But interestingly, apparently, according to the Fort Wayne Journal Gazette, his reception was a bit chilly. Some audience members yelled at McConnell to go back to Kentucky.
Kentucky?
That's where he's from.
Yeah.
Mitch McConnell.
Yeah.
He's not that popular.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Amazing. So Mitch McConnell is getting heckled at his own events. Is that basically what you just said?
Yes. That's what I just said.
Amazing.
Yes.
Okay. What else is going on?
Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton appears to be baffled about Edward Snowden's motive for fleeing the country to expose U.S. surveillance programs. Video has emerged of remarks she made Wednesday night at the University of Connecticut, saying, "I don't understand why he couldn't have been part of the debate here at home," and saying, "When he emerged and when he absconded with all that material, I was puzzled because we have all these protections for whistleblowers." Except, of course, the whistleblower laws in the United States don't cover contractors, and
yeah,
she apparently isn't aware of that.
That's a pretty glaring ignorance.
A pretty glaring omission, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. And she said some other things that might not be too popular with some on the left if she chooses to run with regard to surveillance. Also, Senate Democrats are concerned that children and teenagers could still gain access to candy-flavored electronic cigarettes under new rules from the FDA. A number of senators put out a statement today saying, basically, as long as e-cigarette companies continue to take pages from Big Tobacco's old and cynical marketing playbook, our children will remain vulnerable to the grave dangers of nicotine addiction. In the FDA's new rules announced yesterday that would prohibit e-cigarette manufacturers from selling or marketing to people under 18, the rules did not ban flavors like pina colada, grape soda, and cherry crush.
Right. Yeah. And it just makes sense if you're going to market a product as a way as a safer alternative to smoking, which apparently e-cigarettes are, or as even a gateway out of smoking, that you would not want it to be flavored in a way that would entice people to start with it, if that makes sense.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. House Republicans don't seem to be on the same page when it comes to immigration reform. Representative Mario Diaz-Balart saying to Roll Call newspaper this week that he thinks that things are basically teed up for movement on reform because of various things that have happened over the last several weeks. Of course, he's a key player in any kind of reform that could happen in the House. And yet Eric Cantor, the House Majority Leader, has put out a memo today for the agenda for May in the House, and it includes a whole slew of things, but immigration is notable by its absence.
And didn't Boehner just yesterday or the day before make a speech in which he criticized the Republicans for not being able to get anything done on immigration?
Yes, he did. He mocked House Republicans for not getting anything done on immigration.
Yeah, remarkable. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Victoria, you're brilliant. I hope you have a wonderful weekend. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Good to talk to you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's Anything Goes Friday. And Jeff in Denver. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind today?
Well, I'd like to make a few quick bullet points because things came up before, well, I've been waiting here before I get to my main point. One is, based on what was just said about Seattle and how and homeless people.
Mm-hmm.
At one point, I believe in the past few years, Vegas had more vacant houses than they had homeless people.
Wow. I remember that.
Yeah.
I remember that. It was when the housing crash happened. And I mean, there were so many things that could have been done had we had the Congress and the president that we had in 1933. Don't get me started. Anyway, back to you.
Yeah. Anyway, we don't have a shortage of resources, just ideas. That's all it is.
It's not even ideas. It's willingness to execute, to do things for anybody other than billionaires.
Yeah. As far as the common carrier thing, two other important points that should be mentioned is that the Internet is the most important way of communicating nowadays.
Right.
It's also a two-way form of communication, not like just watching TV.
Right.
And that makes it even more important.
Yes. Absolutely, which is why it's even more vital that it be viewed as part of the commons, and therefore the companies that carry it are considered common carriers.
Yes. And so going to what Ravi was talking about, and first of all, the Social Security and helping the economy, if one thing I have not heard mentioned about removing the Social Security cap is that we could possibly raise so much revenue that we could actually lower the tax rate per person and raise the payouts.
Well, the thing that's more often mentioned, and I think Bernie and Sherrod Brown have both mentioned this, and maybe Jan Schakowsky did a while ago, is that if we lifted the Social Security cap, we could reduce we could either reduce the Medicare tax, or we could do away with the fact that Medicare has that 20% hole drilled in it, since the Reagan era, that has been filled by United Healthcare and AARP and health insurance companies. Yeah. And we could just have Medicare cover all expenses for people who are retired.
Yeah, so the relative benefits would increase in any way, shape, or form.
Yes, if you didn't reduce that, you could either reduce the taxes or you could raise the benefits. Yeah.
But there's a big fringe benefit to what Ravi said about ending the speculation on oil and so forth, commodities such as
that. Oh, it's huge. Bernie is on that all the time. The 20-30% of the total cost of oil right now is speculation.
Well, it could also. Well, usually we want high oil prices to benefit the environment to get people to use less. But
right.
In some cases, it really helps. And right now, tar sands, it could put the nail in the coffin. See, several times we've had oil shale booms, like in Colorado, there have been several. And every time oil prices go down, these things fail because, like tar sands, it requires so much energy that it is not a cost-efficient thing unless oil prices are really high.
Right.
And so by knocking oil prices down, the tar sands in Canada could fail.
Yeah.
Just getting, and right now, it's sometimes I've heard it was like a third of our prices are based on just speculation.
Yep. A much better way to bring the prices down is by bringing down demand, which is by increasing the amount of solar and wind available.
Oh, of course, absolutely. I mean, all the rain and efficient use. Let's stop you. Why do we have 90% of our lights on in the city at night when everybody's asleep at 3 a.m.?
Yep. Yep.
You know, so we could stop that stuff, but also speculation should just be stopped anyway. It's not a part of a
rational. Yeah, and his suggestion, for people who didn't hear it, Dr. Batra's suggestion, he said right now if you want to speculate in stocks, you have to have 50% in margins. In other words, if you're gambling with speculative money, with essentially borrowed money, if you're going to gamble a half a million or $1 million, you got to have $500,000 in the bank. But if you're going to gamble $1 million in oil, you only have to have 5% in the bank, which would be what, 50,000 bucks?
Yeah, and there's another point, though, that was also missed there, wasn't mentioned, is taking possession.
Yeah, yeah. So, A, raise your margin requirement to 50%, and B, require that the only people who can participate in commodity speculation are actual counterparties, people who are actually willing to either supply or take supply of the product itself, in this case, oil. Yeah.
Yes.
Totally with you.
And that's huge, and that's a thing that, in some cases, I believe the rules still exist, but they're just not enforced.
I think that the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, Phil Graham's little gem back in 2000, was the main thing that changed that, although it might have been when his wife, Wendy, was the chairman of the Commodities Trading Commission, that she changed the rules or stopped enforcement of the rules, which would have been a few years before that. It would have been the latter years of the Clinton administration.
So just to end, I'd say a few things could benefit us more than ending speculation. And I mean, if our food prices, you know, if you look at the Arab Spring, a lot of that was not just drought, but it was also speculation of raising prices.
Oh, yeah. Matt Taibbi did a brilliant expose on that, how Goldman Sachs, you know, killed millions of people through starvation and revolution.
Yep. So let's put Goldman Sachs out of our misery.
Yeah, there you go. Jeff, thank you very much for the call. Well said. Mike in Chicago. Hey, Mike, it says you disagree about global warming. Disagree with who?
Hi, Tom. Well, I mean, the normal discussion about global warming I agree with you, that man is responsible for a lot of it. But what I wonder is what condition the planet would be in if mankind weren't here. I mean, I think because of deforestation, the slow controlled burning of natural gas, oil, and coal, I say that we help the planet.
How do you help the planet by throwing 180 billion tons of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere?
Well, just with natural gas, by us controlling the burning of natural gas, if it was uncontrolled and just...
Well, it is relatively uncontrolled right now. But again, my question, how does adding carbon to the atmosphere help the planet?
No, that doesn't help the planet, but I'm saying we're doing more good than bad.
How do you know that?
Well, I'm just assuming it.
Okay, well, let me tell you, Mike, your assumption is wrong. There is a group that was funded by an oil company and some oil billionaires out of Washington State that had been running. They funded a book and a scientist. In fact, I was at a conference that this bozo spoke at about how plants breathe carbon dioxide, and therefore it's more plant food that you're putting into the air. Well, plants do breathe carbon dioxide, and they exhale oxygen. We inhale oxygen and exhale carbon dioxide. There is a natural respiratory cycle between the two. But right now, 50% of the plankton, the plant bottom of the food chain in the oceans is dead because the carbon dioxide is being absorbed by the oceans, and it's not providing food for them. It's making the oceans sufficiently acidic that the stuff can't live there. And what we're finding in other areas is that when you start raising the carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere, yes, at first plants start growing faster, but they're not evolutionarily designed for those carbon dioxide levels. We have carbon dioxide levels we haven't seen in 3 million years. And so what happens is the plants may grow a little faster, and then they start falling over. They get spindly. They don't. So, no, it is not good for the atmosphere. It's not good for the planet for us to be putting carbon into the atmosphere.
See, you're not looking at it from the other angle, that if mankind weren't here, how would the planet be? You don't think it would be bad on its own? I mean, there's plenty of planets that supernovaed and, you know, blew up on its own.
Planets don't supernova, stars do, and our star will in about 5 billion years. But right now, we'd be doing just fine, thank you very much. And even if we were just going through one of the normal oscillations between temperate climates and ice ages, like, you know, we go through every 80,000 years or so, and you can track those back along with carbon dioxide levels all the way back 600,000 years. Humans have only been here 165,000 years. There is a fair body of evidence, you know, from looking at mitochondrial DNA, that during the last ice age, during the last ecological crisis that this planet had, when humans were around, that there was at one point as few as 20, 30, maybe 50,000 humans on the planet. So, you know, if you want to see 7+ billion people die, let's just, you know, create another ecological crisis. Your rhetorical question, Mike, doesn't fly.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I mean, this is the real world. In the real world, go to lasthours.org. You can see the whole thing. It's all right there, lasthours.org. Welcome back. Barbara in Oroville, California, watching us on Free Speech TV. Hey, Barbara, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Hey, Tom. I used to live in Eugene, and you used to come and speak to us once in a while when you lived in Portland.
Yep, at the university there, once or twice a year.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I missed part of that talk that you had with Ravi Batra.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to ask you two questions. Where does gold fit into the investment picture?
I don't honestly know. There's a gold company that's an advertiser on our show, and so it may seem that I'm some kind of big gold advocate. Louise and I own a small amount of coin gold that seems like probably a good idea to have. But I would not put gold at the center of an investment portfolio.
Would you put it any? Oh, so you would make it something small?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I'm just speaking for myself.
Yeah, I'm on Social Security, and I have a really small stock account, and I'm just trying to keep it alive.
Yeah, in terms of large investments, the investment advice that I'm catching on the interwebs from people that I respect is move one's money, and I'm not giving you this advice. I'm just sharing with you what I'm hearing.
That.
I'm not an advisor, and I've done lousy with investments myself in my life.
Yeah.
Other than we bought a fair amount of gold back when it was at $236 an ounce, and we made out very well with that. But other than that. But the point is that they're suggesting that people move their money into a British pound, into there's a German stock market fund, German marks. I think it's GGG or whatever. Anyhow, it's an ETF. Into euros, and into U.S. government bonds, the 10- and 20-year bonds. TLT, I think, is the 10-year fund, and TLF or H or something like that is the 10- and 20-year fund. Basically, keep a lot of money in cash. Basically, get out of the stock market or stay away from it because it's just a very dangerous place right now. But
yeah, I'm getting very nervous about the whole thing.
Yeah.
The other question I wanted to ask you that intrigued me, he was talking about there was some way that we can go around Congress to get the changes made that we want.
Yeah, what Ravi Batra was suggesting was that between executive orders by the president, which would basically raise the minimum wage on anything that the government buys, government actions and government purchasing represents over 20% of the economy. And so right now he's raised the government minimum wage gradually over a multi-year period starting next year on maybe 2% of that. He could do it on 100% of that 20%, number one. And number two, that the Fed could change their monetary policy in a way that would change our balance of trade. Basically, my understanding of it, I'm not speaking for Dr. Batra, my understanding of what he said is basically devalue the dollar in terms of other currencies or have different exchange rates for buying and selling things. I'm not sure how that works, though.
Uh-huh. Well, what would make them do that?
Enough of an economic disaster and the Republicans refusing to do anything in Congress. You know, enough pressure from we the people. I frankly doubt that it will happen. But, you know, Ravi Batra's writing a book. He wants to get it to the president. You know, good on him for that. He's this very, very smart economist. Barbara, thank you for the call. We'll be right back. Welcome back. back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Ted in Seattle. Hey, Ted. Thanks for listening on the radio. What's up?
Yeah, say, my concern is the nuclear energy snuff of information. On the Sunday talk shows a couple of weeks ago, somebody was talking about Ukraine and the fact that 17% of its economy is allocated to the Chernobyl remedy of dealing with what happened in Chernobyl. And that's why the Ukrainian economy is so upside down.
Really?
And
I've never heard that. I know, you know, Chernobyl is in Ukraine, and I'm sure it's an ongoing expense, but 17% seems really high. Are you sure they didn't say that 17% of their electricity is being generated? They have five nuclear plants in Ukraine.
No, it was on the Sunday news show, and this fellow was being on the show with an expert, and he happened to mention that 70, I wrote it down, 17% of the Ukrainian economy goes to dealing with the aftermath of Chernobyl.
That's interesting. Was he saying of the economy or of government spending?
Well, it's just but he said 70% of their economy was allocated to the aftermath of Chernobyl.
That just seems hugely high to me. If it was 17% of government spending, and government spending was, say, 20% of the economy, that might make sense. But in any case, I just don't know. I mean, it may well be true, Ted. Did you want to just share that with me, or was there a question? Or?
Well, the other thing is about the Fukushima, the aftermath of that, and how the cesium-90, we deal as calcium, we absorb it.
Right.
The strontium we deal as potassium, we absorb it.
That's correct.
And
not just us, pretty much all other animals, fish as well.
Yeah. Well, the starfish are all dying off on the West Coast, and the woman at the University of Washington Marine Lab in Friday Harbor, they're trying to find what disease it is. And I've been trying to get in touch with her and say, well, because starfish grow a lot of calcium and potassium real fast. And I think
For cesium.
It's the
and strontium.
And the strontium that's killing the starfish off. And then up at Alert Bay, they have the Indian fisheries that goes out in the spring.
Yeah.
And they have this big herring fishery. And so they went out this year and it was complete debacle. There weren't any herring.
Right. Now, there's another theory, Ted, for I'm familiar with these anecdotes you're sharing with us, and they're big deals. There is, however, an alternative theory that's not a Chernobyl cesium strontium, but rather that we're about to see the ocean basically turn over. You know, the cold water come up, the warm water go down, and the ocean release an enormous amount of the heat that it's accumulated over the last 11 years. And we refer to when that happens, and they typically happens every 10 or 11 years, and it's been 11 years since the last time it happened, we call those El Nino events. And if we get an El Nino event, then the droughts in the Southwest, and yesterday I saw a piece in one of the science publications that California is now at the worst drought in 500 years based on tree stress, you know, looking at tree ring cycles, and that will get even worse. And so it may be that the herring are not moving and the starfish are dying simply because the temperature of the ocean is changing too. So
yeah, but it seems to be all hammering in at the same time.
Yeah, it's the perfect storm. It's the perfect storm.
Fukushima thing.
Yeah, seven billion human beings. I mean, consider in 1800, when this country was founded, there were 1 billion people on the planet. When Thomas Jefferson became president, 1 billion people. 130 years later, when Franklin Roosevelt was sworn into office, there were 2 billion people on the planet. 1930. In 30 years later, when Jack Kennedy was sworn in 1960, that's when we hit 3 billion people on the planet. The next, so 165,000 years of human history for our first billion in 1800, 130 years for our second billion, 30 years for our third billion. Our fourth billion took only 14 years, 1974. Fifth billion took only 13 years, 1987. Sixth billion took only 12 years, 1999. And the seventh billion took whatever it took, you know, 8, 9 years. I don't remember the number. I can't do math in my head that fast. And now we're working on our eighth billion. And we're seeing an exponential explosion in our population. And along with it, we're seeing an exponential explosion in the pollution that we're producing, in particularly the carbon pollution that's going into our atmosphere and consumption of electricity and production of waste and just the whole thing. It's like the biggest failure of the human race is the failure to understand the exponential curve, the exponential function, rather, excuse me, to paraphrase Guy McPherson. Ted, thanks for the call. Good points. Bob in Marcells, Illinois. Hey, Bob, you want to talk about Bernie Sanders running for president?
Bernie Sanders and the girl you had on earlier in the week, who was great. I believe she was filling in for you, and Bernie Sanders came up, and she kind of wrote things off as him not being electable, and I'm thinking, where the heck has our seventh grade civics classes gone that whether somebody is electable has any focus at all on whether or not you should vote for him? You pick somebody that could do the job better than the other candidates,
yeah,
and that's who you vote for.
Yeah, I think Bernie's not only electable, I think, having lived through almost 10 years of elections in Vermont, where he was running for election every 2 years for the House of Representatives, and seeing all these, Bush for President signs right next to Bernie for Congress signs, Republicans love him, Democrats love him, Independents love him, because Bernie Sanders is an OBS guy. He doesn't give you the political shuck and jive. He tells you the actual truth. He talks straight. He means what he says, and he says what he means. And I think, therefore, he actually is very electable. Bob, thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And, in fact, you can get over to pdamerica.org and sign a petition to encourage Bernie to run on the Democratic ticket so he can get into those debates and start influencing the Democrats. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's Anything Goes Friday. So, is Donald Rumsfeld a lizard person? Actually, I think you have more serious things on your mind. So, Paul, listening on KBCS in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Let's just stay with the topic here of the last few minutes. And I was listening to your talk about population growth.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think we're in exponential growth anymore, Tom. I think we're further down the road than that, and that's not a good thing.
Yeah, it started to level off. That's not necessarily a die-off, but it actually we're starting to see in certain parts of the world human die-offs happen. Yes.
Yeah. Well, that's going to say the first part of it's called a sigmoidal curve. The first part of the curve is exponential growth, and that's sort of what you were describing. And then you have linear growth, and that's what you're sort of saying. The last several million, about every 12 or 14 years was a billion.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, it's been more like every 8 or 9 years. No, 10 to 15 years. Yeah. Now it is flattened off. Yeah.
Right, and then it goes into a log phase where it's much more slowly, and then the curve turns over.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get exponential die-off, and then linear die-off, and then logarithmic die-off. So because of unsustainability, you can just put bacteria in a petri dish, and that's exactly how it works.
Right. This is called a sigmoidal curve?
Yeah, it's called a sigmoidal curve. You Google that, and you'll see it's...
Oh, that's interesting. Is that why the sigmoid part of the colon is called that, because it's shaped like that or something, or...? Or is this a sigmoidal curve because it means you're in the crapper? I mean,
no, I think sigmoid is a letter. It's
oh,
I
see.
Is it a Greek S or something?
Oh, okay, got it.
Yeah, so it looks like an S, and if you look at it describes biological growth. I mean, that's biological growth and death in a petri dish in any population of living things. And I don't know why people think that we're exempt from that, but we aren't.
Right.
And It's because of waste. It's because of waste. That's what kills off the bacteria in the petri dish.
Right. You end up drowning in your own waste material.
Yeah.
Or exceeding. I mean, this is also what Robert Thomas Malthus was talking about, and that is that he did not suggest that we were just going to grow, hit a wall, and collapse. He talked about the cycles. We would grow until we exceeded our food supply. Then there would be a die-off until we reached a point where the food supply, you know, was once again available, and then, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, I had to say this to my conservative brother when you said that trees breathe carbon dioxide. No, I said to him, now, Mark, you realize plants don't have lungs, so they don't actually breathe.
Yeah.
They get their, and they actually also, quote, breathe oxygen. They get their carbon dioxide through water.
Yeah.
And so there's only one class of plants that can actually fix carbon dioxide through their leaves. They're called the C4 plants, and I think they're tropical. But they get it through the water. So, and when you put, as you know, when you dissolve carbon dioxide in the water, you get a more acidic, it's more acidic. So more is not necessarily better. Just like if you breathe more oxygen, why divers have to adjust for deep diving? They have to adjust their mix of oxygen so
right.
you don't get oxygen poisoning.
Right. You reduce the oxygen and raise the nitrogen. Are you saying, Paul, that, and maybe I missed this in you know, first year biology, that when leaves absorb carbon dioxide, they're absorbing it not as atmospheric carbon dioxide, but rather as carbon dioxide that's in suspension in moisture that is on the surface of the leaf?
They don't get it through the leaves. They get it through the roots.
Carbon dioxide?
Yeah.
And the leaves are purely for the purposes of photosynthesis.
Yeah. Yeah. And actually, carbon dioxide it's not their food. The sunlight is their energy. Plants also use sugars. They use oxygen to break down sugars,
right.
Just like we do. They do glycolysis just like we do.
Right. And a lot of those sugars are provided by sympathetic bacteria and fungi that are on the roots.
Symbiotes. Symbiosis. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's where the fixing of most of the carbon dioxide comes in is what's dissolved in the water. But no, there's only one class of plants, and I think they're called the C4 plants that actually absorb.
Which means they probably absorb it via methane because
through their leaves.
Because that's CH4.
Through the leaves. But yeah. The photosynthesis is done. It's through the leaves. That's what that's for, and then that's how they make their sugars. They make their sugars by splitting carbon dioxide by using sunlight, right?
Right.
The energy from the sunlight splits carbon dioxide, and then that's what actually ends up yielding oxygen as it's
right. Body. And then they mix it with hydrogen and oxygen from water, and you come up with carbohydrates, carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen all together.
Yeah, it's just a chain of carbons that would otherwise be, you know, greasy, oily things, except for it has, you know, an H and an OH on either side of the carbon, so you get carbo.
Right.
So it's water on each side, and
then a hydroxyl group.
Yeah. Well, it wouldn't be a carboxyl group at that point. It's just carboxyl is a C with a carbon with a double bonded oxygen on one side and an OH on the other side. That's the carboxyl.
Thank you.
Boy, this is getting wonky, huh?
Yeah, it is. I'm starting to remember my chemistry, my organic chemistry. It's good stuff. Anyhow, you called about the minimum wage, didn't you?
Well, yeah, I wanted to say this. The minimum wage, I was listening to Ravi Batra. I was cleaning the house, and for absolutely no compensation, by the way. the minimum wage is, we keep talking how to increase the minimum wage for small businesses is going to it's going to really be hard on small business. But in 1968, when the minimum wage had its most purchasing power, $1.60, and a gallon of gas was 34 cents a gallon. You could buy almost 5 gallons of gas with 1 hour's of wage, right?
Right.
Well, the gas is more than 10 times that much. And so I just figured even now to buy 4.7 gallons of gas, which is what I figured out, would be the minimum wage would have to be $16.94.
Right.
Okay, we've talked about that before, but here's the point. Well, the small businesses were thriving in the 1960s and 1970s. Paying a minimum wage, it was actually worth more.
Yeah.
So, but now small businesses have been run out of business. The restaurant business is a good example where chains come in everywhere and run the individual owners out. Where you used to go for beer and sandwiches, you have to go to a Chi-Chi's or a whatever now, right?
Yep.
Okay, so what has happened is, but the small business, their profit margins are about the same. So if they're paying relatively less than the minimum wage and low-wage workers, and their profit margins are about the same, what's costing them all the money? And I ask if it's barely possible if that big business has not only left the worker in the dust, big business has left small business in the dust too. And that's the problem. It will be a little bit difficult for small business because they're just as poor as the rest of his workers.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's because big business, big corporations have wrecked the country. They've run everybody out of business. And why? And with, you know, the minimum wage, Tom, from 1981 to 1990 was stagnant at $3.35 an hour, the whole Reagan-Bush years. And then it was stagnant. And then it was stagnant again at $5.15 from 1997 to 2007. So for 26 years, the increase from $3.35 to $5.15 over 26 years represents a 53% increase. 53%? But wait a minute. Even gasoline's gone up almost 400%.
Right.
So, I mean, who's been getting rich here and who's been getting left in the dust? The big corporations have wrecked the country. And the small businessman and the rest of us workers are the ones who've paid the price.
Right. And all you have to know to understand all of that without all the sophisticated analysis that you provided, Paul, is all you have to do is play Monopoly.
Yep, that's true.
You know, because at the end of the game, there's one guy left who owns everything, and that's what these people are doing. They're just doing it industry by industry. But increasingly, you're seeing these multi-industry conglomerates like Koch Industries, where, you know, they not only can have a big piece of the paper industry, they also have a big piece of the oil industry, then they have a big piece of the, you know, the media industry, and on it goes.
And that's, nobody else can get in.
That's right. That's the whole point of the game of Monopoly is keep people out. And that's why, that was part of my rant yesterday about net neutrality is that, you know, Comcast and all these companies, you know, as soon as they put in the information superhighway, they're doing the same thing John Rockefeller was doing in his collusion with the railroads back in the 1880s. And or the 1890s, whenever it was, and it's just wrong. Paul, thanks a lot for the call, and it's always great to hear from you. Nancy in Crystal Lake, Illinois. Hey, Nancy, what's up?
Wow, you have such smart callers. Wait till you hear my simple question.
Okay.
First of all, I want to thank you so much for all you do. You, like Senator Sanders, you're a national treasure.
Thank you, Nancy.
I'm calling with reference to Dr. Batra.
Batra, B-A-T-R-A, yeah.
And it was my understanding that he said we basically have not had much inflation over the last few years.
Yes, that's correct.
Is that correct?
That's correct.
But yet, when I go to the grocery store, and this was confirmed to me by cashiers in the Chicagoland market anyway,
right.
The price of groceries has just about doubled over the last 5 years or so.
Whoa.
And is that because of the convoluted way that inflation is now measured?
It could be. I think it's more that we now have Goldman Sachs got into the business of speculating on food. They created a commodities marketplace, and there's all these speculators who are speculating in food and oil and other commodities. And it's driving up the prices of some of these things selectively. Other prices are being driven down, principally in the area of technology. But in terms of inflation as a measure of the value of the dollar, as opposed to prices, we're not seeing a rapid devaluation of the dollar. And that's what he was talking about. Nancy, thank you for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
One way you could see that would be by comparing the United States dollar to other currencies or, you know, some semi-stable commodities, oil or gold, for example. Welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour. I still, you know, Shane says that they're called stomata. Paul, you got to look this up. I still think plants get carbon dioxide through their leaves. Anyhow, Jerry in Long Island, listening on WBAI. Hey, Jerry, you want to talk about Ukraine?
Yes, I did. Yeah, and I heard your conversation this past Wednesday with Stephen Cohn, Professor Cohn, and I had nothing to disagree with him, but I want to add some of my own thoughts, and I specifically want to discuss the media coverage of the situation in the Ukraine. And the problem I have is that, first of all, the corporate-owned so-called mainstream media in this country with respect to it, all we seem to get is this oversimplified and shallow coverage of events in the Ukraine, with the situations constantly being portrayed or characterized as seemingly simply being a matter of Russian-speaking pro-Russian rebels versus pro-European Ukrainians who want to move closer to Europe. But even some of the corporate-sponsored media is now just beginning to admit what your guest Professor Cohen was discussing this past Wednesday, that number one, the pro-Russian Ukrainians, they don't view the new government in Kiev as legitimate precisely because it seized power without elections in a coup in violation of Ukraine's constitution and international law. All we hear in the American media is about how Russia violated Ukraine's constitution and international law by annexing Crimea, but we don't hear any discussion of the inherent way that the new unelected leader of the Ukraine took power.
Yeah, and the annexation of Crimea, by the way, happened after an election.
Right, exactly. And this new guy who's heading up the Ukraine, he just took power in a coup d'etat, which some people don't want to call a coup d'etat. But secondly, there's still very little discussion or acknowledgement in the American media these days about the fact, what I think is the fact, the observation I would make that the pro-Russian Ukrainians who are protesting against this new unelected government, I think they realize, and they might in part be reacting to the IMF austerity package that this new government has agreed to, and which includes a requirement to privatize some currently government-owned industries, and that's in addition to a reduction in pensions and salaries, and that's contrasted to a headline I read in the beginning of April one day in the newspapers that sums it all up in eight simple words. Russia raises some salaries and pensions for Crimeans.
Right.
So as far as I'm concerned, the Crimeans and some others in eastern Ukraine, they're simply voting in their pocketbooks when they try to move closer to Russia. And yet there's virtually no exploration of this economic austerity versus prosperity issue in the American media.
No.
It's all, this is all ignored. It's there's no discussion of what effect the IMF, if it imposed on the Ukraine, it seems to be what it imposed on Greece, what that would mean for the Ukrainians.
Right, but I can tell you, Ukrainians know what it means. And a lot
right,
of them are really fried about
such
it.
There's such little discussion in the media about this.
No, there isn't. The American media, I don't think the average American is well enough informed to even know, A, what the IMF is, B, how the IMF interacts with these countries. We have our media has become so infotainment since Reagan stopped enforcing the Fairness Doctrine and since Clinton signed the Telecommunications Act. Our media has become a joke. And as a consequence of that, the average American is completely, utterly, profoundly, tragically uninformed about the subtleties and nuance of international affairs like you're talking about, Jerry. Thanks for listening to WBAI, where you do hear these things. Hey, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to our executive producer, Sean Taylor, to our associate producers, Shane Farnan and Danielle Gilday, to our video director, Jim Javinsky, to our writer-researchers, Andrew Campbell and Nate Sweet, to Alva Goldberg for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, to our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, to all the folks at our syndicators, Westwood One, Pacifica Radio, Sirius XM Satellite Radio, Cable Radio News Network, CRN Network, Free Speech TV on Dish Network, DirecTV, all the cable providers who carry our program directly, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Network, others around the country, great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on the big picture, to the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, to the folks in our chat room, to Ellen Ratner, Victoria Jones, Bob Ney, and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, to our sponsors, to you for supporting our program, and to Jen for filling in today and answering the phones. Thank you, Jen. You're doing a great job. I don't know if you want your last name on the air, so I'm not going to do that. So anyhow, thank you. Bill, I don't know where you are, Bill, but if you're listening to KPFK, you're probably in the L.A. area, right?
I'm in Lake Elsinore, which is halfway between L.A. and San Diego, inland in avocado wine country.
Uh-huh.
I was going to geological update, but let me go on with the Department of Fish and Game and the ranching industry just pulled off this week in California.
Okay.
One gray wolf discovered in California. Public hearing. Department of Fish and Game put endangered species list. The ranching industry went nuts and just was ballistic and killed it. the last gray wolf.
They killed the wolf?
No, no. The
they killed a hearing.
Put it on the endangered species list. One gray wolf. But they systematically, starting with the bison and the grizzly bear.
Anything that competes with cows.
Yeah, varmints. They filled the most filthiest, disgusting, destructive creature there is. And the ranchers usually are just this mythical Dick Cheney type individual who's just, you know, setting the land for the extraction industries.
Yeah.
Anyway,
Clive and Bundy.
Is it the Department of Fish and Game, the BLM, and the Forestry Disservice will love to sell you a fracking permit, an extraction permit, and close public lands off. Had ranchers point guns at me for mountain biking on, you know, this mosaic patchwork of land between military reservations, government, and private, which it makes no sense either.
Yeah.
And but don't those crackpots with the guns realize they wouldn't even see it coming when the National Guard would fly, or the U.S. Marines fly a Predator drone over them?
Yeah. No, if our government wanted to seriously take them out, you know, showing up with an AK-47, it's pathetic. It's just pathetic. Bill, thank you for the call. Marty in Evergreen Park, Illinois, listening on WCPT. Hey, Marty, what's up?
Hey, Tom, sure. I just wanted to kind of pick up on a topic you were discussing yesterday regarding racism in this country. And I got to thinking, you were talking about the staunch opponents to marriage equality being people who are closeted, you know, homosexuals themselves. I think that people who are racist or people who are vocal opponents against you know, gender equality or people who are against other religions, I think they're just obsessed about those aspects in other people's lives.
Hmm.
Like, I think that people that are racist probably are secretly really wondering what life is like as an African American, or, you know, or just obsess about it. I'm in an interracial relationship, and the topic of race never comes up in our daily lives, like ever. But, you know, I mean, unless we encounter somebody who is overtly racist, but it's just not a central part of our lives the way that probably people who are racist think that it would be. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Does that
sure.
make any sense?
Yeah, it does. I mean, basically, what you're saying is that there's a lot among racists. There's probably a lot of projection going on. Or a lot of, you know, bizarre fascination. I don't want to try and translate what you're saying. I'm trying to understand it, because my theory about people who are homophobic is that we live in a culture, in a society that has historically condemned homosexuality. So if somebody is born either gay or bisexual and they succumb to that cultural disapproval, and then, you know, hide their homosexuality, like, you know, Ted Haggard did, I think is his name, you know, the preacher out west, or Larry Craig, you know. If they hide it, then as part of hiding it, they have to actively and aggressively deny it. They don't have to, but they very often do. Or they assume that other people are making a choice to be gay because they've made a choice to not be gay, or at least not to behave gay. And I'm not quite sure how that translates into race or racism or misogyny, but I think you might be onto something. Let me roll that around in my brain a little bit, okay?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
Yeah,
I think
are obsessed.
I think you're onto something. I'm just not sure where it comes from, because, you know, we're all kind of tribally aware, and we're all gender aware, it's got to be a somewhat different thing. Marty, thanks a lot for the call. Rob in Carson City, Nevada. Hey, Rob, we got a minute until the end of the show. It's yours.
All right, Tom. First off, I want to say I'm very jealous of everybody that gets to go see and David Backman on your 2016. Anyway,
thank you.
As an independent voter in Nevada, I was actually going to vote for Sandoval and Heller this coming election, and they just screwed me up as far as, if they're not going to be lawmakers that uphold the law, then what good are they?
So you're saying that you've dropped your support for your Republican representatives in Nevada because of the Bundy situation?
Well, then I was thinking, I was on the fence on them, and I was thinking, well,
they're doing okay. As Republicans, I thought they were doing what was good for Nevada, and on the Bundy situation, when these are my lawmakers,
yeah,
correct?
And he's a lawbreaker, right? And they're supporting
him. He's a lawbreaker,
yeah.
And they're going to call them heroes and patriots.
Yeah, yeah. I got it, Rob. I suspect that there's probably a lot of people who are going, huh? Varian, you know, the old Scooby-Doo. Huh? Really? And waking up. Rob, thanks a lot for the call. Thanks to all of you for your calls. And Jerry, Michael, Jesse, Robert, Vic, all the others here on hold, I'm sorry we didn't get to you. Try again next week. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, show up, tag your it. Have a great weekend. We'll see you. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.